You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Mike Barton, a very warm welcome to A Mindful Life. I'm always curious with my guests how their childhoods had an influence on their adult lives and career paths. How would you describe your own childhood and influences?
Well, I grew up on a farm. The family farm started in the Lake District, then we moved down to Carnforth in North Lancashire. It was idyllic. I do remember, love working on the farm with my dad, and my dad now recalls that I was one, there were six kids, and I was the one who was interested in the farm. I remember knowing all the cows' names, and even as a 5 or 6 year old, moving the cows around and tying them up. It was just great. But then, because there were six of us, we just used to make our own games up. You know, we'd play. There was one of the barns with a huge roof, and we'd sort of played a sort of a tennis game on it.
So no health and safety in those days.
Yeah, I remember my dad. Oh, well, absolutely. And you've just prompted me with the thought that my dad bought an old dust cart because he wanted the tipper mechanism to make a trailer. Anyway, so once he'd stripped all the tipper mechanism on and the hydraulics, we were left with a chassis, an engine and a seat, a gearbox and a steering wheel. So us kids just drove it up into the big field and we just razzed round on this very unsafe go-kart that was about 20 foot long.
Every kid's dream, by the sounds of it.
Every kid's dream. I mean, of course, it conked out very shortly thereafter because we didn't know how to maintain it, and it had been scrapped for a good reason. But I do remember having 2 or 3 days of enormous fun razzing round on this seat with a big engine on.
Well, you mentioned one of six kids. Were they all boys or...?
No, 5 boys, 1 girl. So I was second.
So where were you in the pecking order?
Yeah, well, I think I was probably bottom in the pecking order, but I was second in age. No, it was just great fun. We brought each other up.
I think you find that on a farm, don't you? Because it's you're sort of living at work, aren't you, I suppose? So you've got to get on and you've got to work together.
Yeah, and Mum and Dad were always there because it was a livestock farm, a dairy farm. I always remember Christmas Day being a special day because Dad, after he called it doing up in the morning and doing up at night. So doing up just meant you were feeding everything and milking. Right. We always went out and helped on Christmas Day so he could finish early and then come in. And that was a special day because he didn't do anything between the two milking. So it was sort of like a family day. And when I became, moved into adult life, it always struck me as being different that people left home to go to work. I'd just been brought up with you were at work and you were at home and it was all one thing.
I'm curious, I mean, I don't know what your brothers and your sister did when they got to adult life, but there's no thoughts of carrying on your father's...
Oh, well, I did. So, I mean, I went to university to study law. I went to the grammar school and it was sort of a drawn into a journey of life. And the journey of life at the grammar school was you would go to university. And it was while I was at sixth form, I thought, I quite fancy joining the police. So went down to Lancashire Police Headquarters in about 73, 74. And you know, I'm thinking of joining the police, but I'm also thinking of going to university. And I'd heard a rumour that you could join the police, then go to university. Anyway, Superintendent Quayle it was, and Sergeant Jerry Rothwell told me that, oh, no, we don't want you to come here. We want you to go to university, learn a bit about life. And now when I realise, you know, I must have been a long-haired, spotty teenager and what the hell did they want one of them for in the cops? So off I went to university, and it was when at university I wanted to go back to farm because I missed it. Yeah. So I farmed with my dad for a couple of years, but it didn't work out. There wasn't enough money on a small tenanted farm in North Lancashire for two families. So I joined the cops in 1980. Yeah.
Well, people join the police for all sorts of reasons, I suppose. Some noble reasons, I suppose, you know, wanting to help people, the usual thing, and then other people kind of just fell into it. Where would you put yourself in that?
Well, we always make our truths fit, don't we, when we look back on life. But I do recall being inspired by policing by my auntie, my mum's younger sister, who was a police officer. And, yeah, I liked her stories of derring do.
So she just told you the good bits.
Oh, God, I hope so. Why the devil would you tell an aspiring teenager the bad bits? I think also I was probably inspired by all the police dramas. The police dramas in the 1970s were ubiquitous like they are now. I mean, not quite as gritty as they are now, as I recall. That may be nostalgia taking over. Nevertheless, they were inspiring. And also, I do recall watching 12 Angry Men, black and white.
Oh, great film.
Great film, which is all about how the jurors are persuaded by the Henry Fonda character to actually recognise that they were sleepwalking into a miscarriage of justice where a Latino boy was going to be fitted up for a murder that he didn't commit. And I think it was the raging sense of injustice and what might happen with injustice that was probably a core moral calling to the police.
Yeah.
But also the subplot, of course, the subtext is that the police and the court process itself was skewed and biased.
It's an interesting film, and I think it's just as valid today as it was when it was made in the 50s, was it?
If not more so.
So, as you say, you became a police officer and rose fairly quickly through the ranks in various roles. You ultimately became the chief constable of Durham Constabulary. I just wondered, did you ever think then that as a young officer that one day you'd be occupying that demanding position?
I think when I was a snotty, obnoxious teenager, I did. Before I joined the police, I said, I think I'm going to be a chief constable. And when you join, you realise that, blimey, you'll be lucky to get inspector, pal. So it may have been something that was said when I was a teenager, but I certainly didn't aspire to that when I joined the police. In fact, I aspired to being a village bobby because having been brought up in a farming community, you're always coming into contact with local police officers who always struck me as being good eggs and just nice people, and they always had the time to lean on a gate and chew the fat.
Yes.
Might be a bit different now, of course, but in those days, that's what they did. I joined with a law degree in 1980, which was unusual. I actually joined in 1979, but I deferred my entry till 80 because my dad wanted me to work that winter. Very rarely did people join with a law degree then, so I was already singled out as slightly unusual, I think. And people were encouraging me to join the graduate entry scheme, and I refused to join it.
Was there a reason why?
Yeah, because I wanted to have a solid base to my career. Farming's all about knowing your business and being up to your elbows in soil and understanding the basics. And if you don't understand the basics, you can't do it right. A bit like an apprenticeship. And I didn't want to fly and not have that deep understanding of what the job was all about.
I suppose if a role is a stepping stone, you don't really get to know it, do you?
Yeah, and I think my aunt had already pointed out, you know, that more fun was to be had in the constable and sergeant role than any other rank.
I think she's probably right.
Oh, she's nailed on right. Other than perhaps chief constable, you can have a bit of fun there. I did quite well in my sergeant's exam, but refused to, you know, go on the accelerated scheme. And shortly after getting into CID, couple of years after being in CID with 5 years in, they promoted me to sergeant. And I was ambitious, you know, I took all my exams as soon as I could. And then I was an inspector with 9 years in, rather languished as an inspector for 11 years, which was when I think you and I first met.
But of course that would have been good experience because certainly I remember CID at Blackpool, which is where we both were, to kind of corral RC detectives. It's not an easy job.
I learnt a lot. I learnt a lot, certainly being DI at Blackpool, that's for sure. That was in the mid-90s. So for your listeners, we didn't have intelligence-led policing then. That was just the start of the intelligence-led policing, the national intelligence model, creating intelligence units. Mm. I helped create the first intelligence unit in the mid-90s in Blackpool with DS and 2DCs. And they were really interesting times. But I do remember, and Pauline Clare had just arrived as our chief. She was great. What a wind of change she brought. Mm. And so we were getting all this stuff from headquarters about, you know, we really need to change, you know, trying not to be quite so misogynistic. I think we're still working on that, aren't we? But I remember we got these posters through from headquarters. There were no such thing as emails in those days. So I would dutifully put these up around the CID office in Blackpool and was ridiculed both to my face and to my back. But I knew I'd won when somebody scrolled over one of the posters. When the wind of change blows, build a windmill, not a shelter. Anyway, that defaced poster was not taken down because people had started to cotton on to the fact that there's something in this change thing that's for the better.
Somebody told me once that if you're a good street cop, then you can do any job in the police, including the chief constable role.
It's about that street cop thing. Mm. And I did enjoy being a police officer. As I say, I locked quite a few people up for acquisitive crime, and hence getting on CID with 3 years in there, I was asked to apply for CID. Didn't realise then, you don't realise with 3 years in the politics of the organisation, but I'd been a CID aide, and they said, oh, you need to go to headquarters, the detective chief super wants to interview you. Oh, right. So okay. Off I went. I was interviewed and I was on CID pretty much straight away, and that was because I'd obviously
showed an
impressed.
Attitude, shall we say.
Obviously impressed. But I do remember when I went to Durham as assistant chief in 2008, I had 28 years in then, and I'd been detective chief super in Lancashire. I remember meeting one or two difficult characters up in Durham, and I think they thought that somehow they were going to be able to pull the wool over my eyes. And because I'd spent a long time on the front line, I was in control of how to approach policing, and I absolutely understood if I was being conned. And I remember it was Detective Chief Super tried to pull the wool over my eyes, and I lowered my glasses and pointed out to him that I'd been in there and done it.
You'd been up to your elbows in the soil, as you said earlier.
Yeah, and we then had an uneasy truce. He retired and off he went, but my early years of understanding implicitly what the nuts and bolts of policing were, I was sometimes able to outmaneuver and out-argue people who were describing what was really going on. And I think if there's been a theme throughout my career, there are too few bosses who absolutely understand what it's like to be at the front line. If they did remember, if they did ever know, they've certainly forgotten.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I've always said that, you know, my superiors when I was serving, and I actually said it sometimes, don't forget what you're asking your troops to do. Don't think it's easy. Don't take it for granted. Really understand what you're asking them to do, because it's a hard job to do.
Yes, it's a hard job, but it's a privilege. I always wanted to be outward focused as a police officer. I do plead guilty to sometimes being, not always having a great deal of sympathy for some of my colleagues who wanted to concentrate on their own trauma rather than consider the trauma of the people that they were going to help.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
It is. It's a balance. And I do remember one case where I had a colleague who'd faced a series of traumas, and they were dreadful. And it was just utterly coincidental, but dreadful nevertheless. And I do remember that was the time when I started to understand what sort of professional help there was out there for colleagues in distress. That was in the early noughties. Yeah, worked a lot with very knowledgeable psychologists since then in policing. But I think I do have feet of clay. I'm not perfect by any means. And one of my weak points is I don't like laziness. And of course, I perceive laziness from a very subjective point of view.
Yeah.
And that just comes from having worked on a farm. You've just got to graft. You graft 16 hours a day.
Yeah, well, I think probably what you saying is that you had a resilience, didn't you? And police officers have to be resilient and be responsible for their own well-being. I agree with you from that point of view.
And I think also, if you're not cut out for it, don't do it. That's not to say that you've got to be cavalier with people's lives and their careers, but when all's said and done, it's another job. And if you were a plumber and you kept fitting the cold tap to the hot tap and vice versa, then the person who was training you would probably invite you to go and do another job. And I think it's the same for policing. It's a wrench because it is a calling for many people. But ultimately, if you're not cut out for it, do something else.
Well, that's interesting because while we were talking, I was thinking about going off a little bit of a tangent here, which is great. That's why I like doing these things. It seems that the police these days don't seem to have the professional curiosity they once had.
When I joined the CID, it was before PACE. CCTV was a twinkle in somebody's eye. Mobile phone data, goodness me, you'd have to read a science fiction novel to understand what that might be. What you had to do is You went to the crime, you spoke to witnesses, you preserved the scene, you did what you possibly could, and then you tried to rebuild your understanding of that crime from scraps of clues that you had to look after assiduously. Now, I think I do worry that we've got a generation of police officers who, if they haven't got CCTV, if they haven't got mobile phone data, if they haven't got, you know, virtually a Hollywood blockbuster showing the offender in flagrante, there's nothing to investigate. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. And I do look at the detection rates now, and I do think it's not young cops now joining. It's an entire culture in policing of not investigating. I always, and I worked out this when I was a DI, I didn't go for the broad spectrum of detection rates. That's just ridiculous. If you've got lots of shoplifting in the middle of it all, that automatically inflates your detection rate. But I always said there are two crimes that I'm going to measure to test the health of an area, and that's stealing from motor vehicles and burglary dwelling. I always chose those two words because when people rang in to say that their car had been broken into or their house had been burgled, they didn't know who had done it. So if they rung in and said, I've just been punched in the face, they'd sometimes tell you who'd done it. And then, so we go along and then we arrest the person who they've named and we sort of preen ourselves as if we're Sherlock Holmes. Well, it wasn't really a mystery, was it? I always measured mysteries. And the two classics, and they were reasonably volume crimes as well, so you had a good sample set to go at, were stealing from motor vehicles and burglary dwelling. There are some forces in the country that have got a 0.5 detection rate, 0.5% detection rate for stealing from motor vehicles. Well, they might as well not call themselves a police force. Now, when I left Durham, we were knocking about the late teens, 20%, which was way more than anywhere else in terms of the detection rate for those two crimes. The reason why that was important, I wasn't being a slave to figures, but what I was saying to the organisation was, if you can't solve mysteries, then you're not going to be any good when it's obvious what you're looking at, or not so obvious. For example, if you are really good at investigating crime where you don't know who's done it, then you'll be a little bit better at investigating crime where you think you know who's done it. And I don't think it's individual cops who are joining now. I think they're joining a culture that doesn't value investigation. They somehow have been seduced by the easy hits.
Okay, risk aversion, let's tackle that.
I understand why risk aversion is something that's powerful in policing, because if you join the police, then generally you're saying that you're conservative with a small c, because you're there to enforce the status quo. That's what the police do. You know, we don't make new laws. We're there to keep the peace and enforce the laws that are currently on the statute book. That tends to be a more conservative-minded person. I'm not talking about party politics now. One tends to be more of a static person than a creative person. Policing is a dangerous occupation, intrinsically dangerous. And that's what we do in the emergency services. We run towards danger. If you try to eliminate danger, then you completely defeat the purpose of the job. And I think what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that we mitigate the danger to our staff. A lot of people talk about arming our police officers because of the threat. But of course, we know in this country, and we've demonstrated it time and time again, that restricting the amount of guns out there and creating a culture that doesn't like guns is much safer than arming every police officer, because that would just turn into an arms race. It's that risk aversion that sometimes wants to overcompensate for what they see in front of them, rather than accepting the risk and using the ingenuity of individuals to make sure that they're safe.
Moving on, I think it was 2019, The Economist wrote an article about you whilst you were the chief constable at Durham. According to the article, your staff described you as forthright, daring and a little domineering. They also said that you were a nutter, but you were their nutter. What struck me from the article was that there was a huge amount of mutual respect between you and your staff.
I didn't agree with everything that was in that Economist article, but that's journalism, isn't it?
Yes.
And I've got to say,
I think nutter was a bit strong.
Well, no, I didn't actually worry about nutter. I've spent 40 years in policing, so if you can't cope with being called a nutter, I've been called worse. One of the things that I learned from that was that how powerful an article like that, you know, full page spread in the Economist, the number of people across the country who contacted me. And at the time, you don't realise just how powerful journalism can be in terms of telling a story. The nutter, our nutter bit is, I just always wanted to be creative. And I always wanted to create a culture where people felt that, not that they could break the rules willy-nilly, but they could break the rules to do the right thing. So in any given circumstance, do the right thing regardless of the consequences. Do the right thing. Sometimes, you know, if people produce a 50-page rule book where you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. Whenever I was a police officer and I went to any circumstance, they were always different. And you couldn't possibly overlay a rule book and get to the right answer for people who were probably facing the worst day of their lives. You know, and I think it's perfectly acceptable for a police officer to put his arm round a traumatised victim. But if you put it in the rule book that, well, when you go to a victim and they're traumatised, well, you've got to hug them, it's ridiculous. So you want there to be a real human approach to policing that doesn't necessarily follow the rules, but gets to the right answer and is honourable all the way through. It's full of integrity. And I think the way that you unleash that individual integrity is you show people that you are going to be you, come what may. So I was always me. I was always my authentic self. I would occasionally get cross. I would crack a funny sometimes when some people might think it was slightly inappropriate. But you and I know that humour is one of the best assets of a street cop, because it punctures the tension, whether it's high drama or violence. Yes. That's the sort of approach that I used. And I think because people weren't used to that in a senior officer, whenever I turned up at a police station, if it was untidy, the first thing I'd do is tidy up or sweep up outside. Because they weren't used to that in a senior officer, their shorthand description of that was, well, he's a nutter, but he's our nutter.
There's very few people I can think of that have been promoted, gone through the ranks and been that same person they were when they joined. I don't know, it's almost like the job sucks the personality and the character out of them and they become very corporate, I suppose, when they get to the higher echelons.
I think sometimes those sort of sometimes faceless, nameless, bureaucratic senior officers always had that in them when they were on the front line.
I suppose it's courage just to be yourself.
They and it's a risk. That. It's a huge risk.
Because everybody wears a mask in the police, don't they?
Yeah, and you have to sometimes. You've got to don your mask. So there's absolutely no point going into a family tragedy and then bawling with everybody, there is a time to shed a tear, and you might shed a little tear, but there's absolutely no point being uncontrollably wailing in the middle of a family tragedy. You've got to be professional, and they want that. They want a compassionate professional, but they want you to be you. Yeah. So, and the way that you do that is you don your mask. I do think that there are too many people in top jobs who have forgotten what it's like to be on the front line. By the same token, when they said in the Economist Domineering or whatever it was, I absolutely had no truck with people who were not delivering. I think when we were preparing for this, you were recalling the first time that we actually had a conversation. That, for me, epitomises the way that I approached it. So
it was 1998, so I'd just literally been in a year. I was independent and I was on one of the FACE courses, and I had to give a presentation on legalisation of sex work, prostitution. Man, I gave this 20-minute presentation. You were there, you were the detective inspector, there was members of the SMT, chief supers and all the rest of it. So quite a nervous young officer was giving this presentation, and about 20 minutes long, you fired into me with lots and lots of questions and what ifs and trying to gem my conclusions apart. Felt exhausted at the end of it. Then you came up afterwards and said, actually, Dave, that was quite a good presentation. I've never forgotten that.
I do remember that. And I actually remember somebody giving a presentation on legalising sex work. And I actually think that there's a lot to be said for this, by the way. Mm. Albeit I was probably playing devil's advocate with you. It was to probably prepare you for cross-examination in court. You passed. You obviously passed, though.
Well, I don't think I've ever been cross-examined as badly as that.
As well as that.
Yeah, as well as that, yes.
I think it's, if we're curiously professional, and you talked about professional curiosity, then we should be able to cope with, withstand, enjoy that cross-examination. I think it's incumbent on each other as professionals to challenge each other. If we become complacent and follow the herd, that's when we start making dreadful mistakes. That's what we did throughout the last 20 years with child sexual exploitation. Everybody starts listening to the received wisdom, and it's nothing like received wisdom. It's nonsense. And the only way that you can do that is by actually openly challenging each other. Some of the best things that have happened to me have been my failures, you know, where I've failed in promotion process or made a mistake and being found out, and then you learn to accept that you'd made a bit of a faux pas and learn from it. I wouldn't change anything, even the bad bits, because it allows you to have that varied, fulfilling career.
I've tried not to mention austerity because it's a big, big topic for every police officer, and it normally involves their faces going red. Durham Constabulary were no different to any other force in having cut to their budgets, yet you managed to do what a lot of people couldn't, turn it into the best performing force in the country. What was your secret to that?
Well, I didn't fight austerity, I accepted it. It's a burning oil platform, so use it. We had to make compulsory redundancies, and the people we selected were not our best performing people. So we didn't do last in, first out, which is what the unions wanted. We didn't go for voluntary redundancies solely. You have to do voluntary redundancies before you go to compulsory redundancies. But if people were asking for voluntary redundancy and they were exceptional workers, we refused to let them have it. And then we went for compulsory redundancies on a significant scale. Nobody else did that. We also encouraged officers who lost their mojo to clear off as well and do something that they were better suited to. And you could actually do that under the Windsor reforms, but nobody else was doing that. A lot of forces actually enforced a rule that if you'd got 30 years in, you had to clear off. And we didn't do that. And the reason I didn't do that, if anybody worked beyond their 30 years, they were really cheap because they were still paying into the pension and they weren't drawing the pension. So if you had a police officer with over 30 years in who was still working, you were actually paying them a third of their wage. All of the forces, because they could, they got rid of those people. The most experienced people who wanted to work. And we didn't do that. So I saw a lot of police forces making mistakes. Another mistake that police forces made was to cut their neighbourhood policing.
I think we're all seeing the fruits of that now, aren't we?
Well, I didn't cut any. Not one. Not one PCSO and not one PC from neighbourhoods. I asked them to do more, but we kept them where they were. We cut the number of panda car drivers by a third, and we insisted on single patrolling. So one officer in the car, not two. And if it was a violent incident, send two cars. If ever a sergeant or an inspector complained to me that they were short of staff, I'd just check whether or not they'd been double crewing or not. And if they had, I'd say, well, you obviously haven't got it. You've obviously got too many staff because you're putting two people in a car. Obviously, there are certain situations where you need two people in a car, for example, if they're armed officers. But by and large, you will see up and down the country now, loads, and I'm not talking about recruits, you know, who have to be working with somebody. You'll see loads of double crewing, and it's wasteful. And also, like I always have done, we've developed all our own software, so it was two clicks away from whatever the officer wanted, you know. As a result of making all of those back office savings, insisting on officers, you know, stepping up to the mark, making sure you cut in the right place, making sure it was the right people who were leaving the organisation, freed up our first-line supervisors like you've never seen. Our performance leapt when we got rid of people who didn't really want to be employed by us. So there's loads of organisations that spend 80% of their HR function, their leadership function, on trying to drive reluctant warriors to the front line to do less than optimal work. So I treated Durham a bit like the family business. You know, if you're running a family business, would you employ somebody who's lazy? Would you employ somebody who doesn't come to work? Well, you wouldn't. Well, why would you do that in policing? It's more important that you employ people who want to come to work and do a good job.
Did you encounter much resistance when
it was completely plain sailing, David. I slept until 11 o'clock and went home at 3. Was there resistance? Of course there was. It was absolutely awful. It was awful for the people who left the organisation, of course it was. But we organised employment sessions. So we found out the big employers who were employing at the time, and we arranged for the staff to have employment fairs with those people. There were more than a handful of individuals that went through a really tricky time, and I'm certainly not going to. But we were given 30% cuts by the government, and there was absolutely no point me spending more money than we had, because you can't do that. Physically, you can't do that. Nor morally, as a leader, you've got to work with the cloth that you're given. So you've got to do it in as humane way as you possibly can. But you've got to focus on the most important people in all of this. They're the people who are calling for service. So I insisted, in the middle of austerity, that we went to every job. And a lot of middle-ranking officers thought I was a nutter. But I insisted on it. Because I said, if you don't go, then you're then going to have that slippery slope where somebody in Cornwall will say, well, we don't need to go to that, we don't need to go to that. And before you know where you are, there was one police force that, when I was chief constable and we were going to over 90% of all jobs, they were going to 25% of all jobs, and the chief officer thought that that was acceptable. Now, as a result of going to those jobs, you resolve the situation and those people don't return calls. The biggest problem, excuse me, that policing has is the repeat callers. And they're drowning policing. And if you actually go to the first time they call, you'd probably be able to resolve it. And they're not repeat callers. But people thought I was crazy that I was insisting that we went to every call, when actually not to go to a call was just being a hostage to fortune. In the private sector, if a cafe or a restaurant or a business responded to 25% of all requests for business, they'd soon go out of business, wouldn't they? So you just got to look at the sensibilities of the private sector and adopt it.
I suppose one of the controversies was your attitude on drugs. And I remember seeing you on BBC Question Time. You gave quite an impassioned speech to the audience. Do you remember that?
I mean, it wasn't planned. The question was, two mums were there and their teenage children had been robbed at knife point, and other speakers had made the link to drug markets and how dreadful it was that drug dealers were taking over the area. And I simply pointed out the inconsistencies in the arguments and the illogicality of what we're doing vis-a-vis drugs. The Americans have demonstrated, obviously for us, that making something illegal doesn't resolve it. So they made alcohol illegal in the 1920s, and all they did was create the mafia, and that's exactly what we've done here. And what I described was the police had done the public's bidding, politicians' bidding. We've tackled the drugs markets, drug dealers. But what we do is we arrest drug dealers, we put them into prison, and within 2 or 3 hours, there's a replacement drug dealer. But they don't take over on their own. There's actually quite a fierce battle in the background where 2 or 3 vying drug dealers will try and take over the market, and the most violent one wins. So when we get around to arresting that drug dealer and we put them in prison, there's another fight for the territory and the most violent wins. And this is a Darwinian spiral of violence. So when you make something illegal, you don't get rid of it. And you certainly don't get rid of drugs, because drugs do actually grow on trees. So what we've done is we've got something that grows like a weed in parts of the world, and we've given the monopoly of this to organised crime. So now the people, I'm not saying drugs are good and Class A drugs are good for you, but what I'm certain of is that the people who are in charge of the quality, the distribution, are all criminals who keep their ill-gotten gains for themselves, accumulate fortunes, and then use it for their own political ends. There are now significant countries in the world that have completely lost the battle to be civilized, whether that's Mexico or Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan. We've just given over civilized countries to organized crime, and there are parts of Britain like.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it was at the turn of the century, 19th into the 20th century, the government debated on what to legalise, whether it was alcohol or drugs, and they chose to legalise alcohol, I think. And obviously, you know, that's one of the biggest killers in society. It's a moral thing, isn't it? Who decides what's a bad drug and what's a good drug? Because they'll all kill you.
Taken to excess or incorrectly, then they kill you. But actually, we demonstrated throughout the 60s that you can be on heroin all your life and lead a perfectly normal life. It's not as optimal as if you don't take heroin. Cocaine was legal. Coca-Cola had cocaine in it. That's why it's called Coca-Cola. When they first synthesised, I think it was Bayer in Germany, first synthesised heroin, diamorphine and aspirin at the same time, the doctors refused to test aspirin on themselves because they thought it was more dangerous than heroin. What we've got is, heroin is legal. Alcohol is illegal. Alcohol is illegal if a 5-year-old goes into a shop and tries to buy it. Heroin is legal if you're in a care home and somebody needs palliative care because they're in great pain. It's diamorphine. But we've allowed the media, and we've fallen into the trap ourselves where we say heroin's illegal and alcohol's legal. They're not. They're both controlled. And all I was asking for was a questioning of how we control certain drugs. So when people accuse me of saying, oh, well, I think you think that Class A drugs should be legalised, I don't. I think we should change the way that we control them. So, for example, if somebody's addicted to heroin, we should offer them heroin as part of their treatment programme, not methadone. Methadone is a synthesised opiate that was developed by drug companies in America, and then they flogged it to everybody. Exactly the same as fentanyl. So the opioid crisis in America now has been created by the drugs firms, and we've paid for it all. If somebody's addicted to heroin, offer them heroin, bring them in, give them clean heroin with clean needles. The reason why most people die of heroin is not because of the heroin itself, because of the impurities and all the other diseases they get because they inject in dreadful circumstances. So that's all I'm saying.
finally, as Mike Barton enjoys retirement, although I suspect you're probably not retired, do you miss it, first of all?
Yeah, but life's all about chapters. And I don't miss seeing more of my 6 grandchildren. Because I probably missed a lot of the upbringing of my 3 children. And I wasn't going to make that mistake again. So what you lose is more than balanced with the richness of the new. I'm still in touch with a few people. My time has come and gone in policing. You know, we're
batting holders, aren't we, I suppose?
Yeah, we are. We're tenants, and somebody else will take over. One hopes that one has left a little bit of a mark, a little bit of a memory, a little bit of a positive impact on people's lives. You know, I'm 65, but I've got 75-year-old knees, so it's probably a good thing.
You're looking well on it, considering the pressures of the job. You're doing okay.
Well, you've got to enjoy life, haven't you? And I enjoy reading, enjoy gardening, I enjoy having a bit of laugh with my family. And, I mean, I'm still asked to do the occasional thing, which keeps the grey matter going. But, no, I think it's important to enjoy things, but not to live with regrets and to live in the present, not the past or the future.
Yeah, oh, I fully agree with you there. I'm just looking out your window now. You mentioned gardening. I can see a very well-stocked greenhouse. Is that one of your labours of love?
Yes, it is. So tomatoes are in full spate now, so I'm rather proud of that. Courgettes, we've now got very interesting recipes for our courgette. I'm working on probably a skin lotion or a shower gel of courgettes. No, I'm not. I'm teasing, but we've got that many. You could nearly bathe in them. But I just love it. I mean, it's a lovely view, isn't it? And been enjoying some nice weather, and we've just had 2 of the grandkids stay with us for a week. And it's just been such a pleasure just to see them running around the garden on the swing, on the slide, just enjoying that idyllic childhood that we all remember.
Well, it's as you say, isn't it? It's that all-important word, perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, recognising things for what they are. I've been privileged and lucky, and I think I'm grateful for that.
Mike Barton, thank you very much indeed.